Hi, Bomb Squad. Welcome to The Future of Food, a Radio Cherry Bomb miniseries. I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. The Cherry Bomb team toured America last year and traveled from Nashville to Chicago to Dallas and lots of places in between to ask women what the future of food means to them. Throughout this series, you're going to hear talks and panels that we recorded on each stop. You'll hear from ice cream entrepreneurs, established restaurateurs, some major top chefs, and a poet. These members of the Bomb Squad share their vision for what's next in their world and the world around them. I hope this series inspires you to stop and think about your future. Thank you to Kerrygold for supporting our tour and this mini-series. Kerrygold is the iconic Irish brand known for its award-winning butter and cheese made with milk from grass-fed cows. For this episode, we're traveling to Portland, Oregon. Our event was held at the Knightwood Society, the wonderful woman-run event space. We're going to kick things off with one of the most respected chefs around, Naomi Pomeroy, of Beast and Expatriate. First, let's check in with our sponsor. There are so many things you can do with cheese beyond just making a cheese board, and who knows that better than a cheesemaker? We checked back in with Sarah Furno, the farmhouse cheesemaker whose family created the famous Kerrygold Cashel Blue Irish farmhouse cheese. We asked Sarah for some of her favorite ways to cook with Kerrygold cheese.
There's loads of different ways. If I'm with my kids, we might be making pizza with like a quattro formaggio with, you know, Cashel Blue and maybe some aged Kerrygold cheddar and some mozzarella, or I might pop it into a risotto, I love making inverted burgers for friends if they come over.
Inverted burger? I've never heard of that. Stay tuned to hear Sarah explain exactly how she makes this inventive burger with Kerrygold Cashel Blue Irish farmhouse cheese. Interested in putting your own spin on dishes with Kerrygold's award-winning butter and cheese? Visit KerrygoldUSA.com for recipes and inspiration. That's KerrygoldUSA.com. Let's welcome Chef Naomi Pomeroy.
You know, I didn't really know, and I didn't feel like I had the right, I guess, to say this feels weird. You know, like I come to work and I really hate coming to work because you guys are going to make a bunch of like sexist jokes about me, and I don't think that there's anything I can do about that because it seems to be that that's just sort of the way it was. And it was a long time ago, to be fair. It was like, you know, 1998 or whatever. But at the same time, I think, you know, something clicked inside of me and I was like, wow, I really hate this. So I stopped laughing, first of all, because at first I was so uncomfortable, I was laughing at the jokes, you know, just kind of, ha ha, this is funny, right? We're all making fun of me. This is cool. And then after that, I started being quiet. And then one day it just kind of built up and we sat down at the end of our shift to, you know, talk about what we needed to order for the next day. And I said, I quit. I just said, I quit. They had no idea that I was unhappy. I was laughing, you know, through all the jokes, and I just gave no notice and walked out, never went back to that job again, and basically started my own business after that. So even though there's like that silver lining of maybe those guys drove me to start my own business, in looking back on that moment, I feel like if I could redo that moment as an adult, I would say that I missed a moment there too, because instead of telling them why I quit, I just quit. And that was it. And sometimes I think about, you know, how much things have changed. Like, okay, recently, like with the Me Too movement, what is the Me Too movement and the restaurant industry like? What do they have in common? Because ultimately, you know, it's really complex equation. For those of you who work in the front of house, you know that you are working for tips for the most part. Actually, at my restaurant, you're not working for tips. So if any of you need a job, we don't do tips at my restaurant. We are completely just by the hour. But for the most part, we're working for tips. And if we're not working for tips, we're working for something like tips, like approval or whatever. So, you know, ultimately that creates a power imbalance. And a lot of what we end up taking on is this idea like, You know, as a server, when someone brushes your leg inappropriately, you kind of know it's inappropriate, but in the past, it's been like, you don't say anything, right? Like, you might say something, you go back with your women friends or your other server friends, and you complain about the guy on table three that touched your leg, and it was so gross, and but nobody confronts the guy. So I think that we're working in a time when it's the responsibility of business owners, leaders, bosses, men and women, to start to realize that those kinds of things need to be taken really seriously, first of all. But second of all, I think we have to realize, like, this whole conversation that I'm having with you guys today came from really thinking about consent. Came from thinking about consent and what does that mean in the era of Me Too and in the dynamic of being inside of a kitchen or a restaurant in general. And I was driving home the other day and I was listening to this podcast called Dear Sugars. Have you guys ever listened to that? Yeah. So Cheryl Strait is a friend of mine, and I had never listened to the podcast, but for some reason, I was downtown, and I was like, I have 45 minutes to get from downtown, like, to back to work again. It was like a rush hour. And so I put on the podcast, and I was listening to it. It was about consent, and it was about how part of consent is about the person who is in power realizing that they are in power, right? And taking a certain level of extra responsibility because of that power dynamic. I just want to say that in that moment when I could have said to them about why I was quitting, I should have said why I was quitting. Because it's a teachable moment where people can then learn what it is for you as a person experiencing whatever they're doing. Like, how many people in the room have been told a joke that made them feel really uncomfortable but just kind of laughed and didn't say anything about it? Like, pretty much, I mean, I would guess pretty much everyone. And, you know, I've realized in reflecting, like, how my laughing at it instead of saying that this makes me feel uncomfortable is part of the problem of why those things keep continuing. And in my kitchen, in my restaurants, what I try to do is create an open forum and a dynamic that has people feeling like they can come to me to say something if they feel like something crossed the line. And what I always do is encourage them to go back to that person and talk to that person about how it made them feel. Because ultimately, you can say things like, well, that comment was so racist, or that comment was so misogynistic. But that kind of conversating with someone doesn't really create movement. The kind of thing that you do in that moment is have compassion and sympathy for how they ended up making those comments, right? Like, where you're like, wow, you must be in pain from having to make, like, racial jokes, or, you know, you must be suffering, you know, as a woman coming up through the kitchen. I feel like there was many, many years when I participated in that stuff on a daily basis because I felt like acting like a man, you know, or acting like someone in power who wasn't controlling their power well was the only thing that I had to emulate. That was how I was going to get successful. You know, someone slaps my butt and I'm like, and then I see that they get promoted, and then I realize, oh, that's how you do it. Just slap people's butts. That's how you get promoted. And it really is a culture that runs across restaurants, and it's a really dangerous culture. So I just wanted to say that I think that as bosses, our job, if you're a boss, is to create, balance out some of that power and create a safe environment for people to come to you with stuff that in the past I would have said to people like, hey, just whatever, it's a kitchen, like, toughen up, that's how it is. But at the end of the day now, what I would say to someone that felt that way was, wow, how can we make you feel more safe? And do you feel like you can talk to that person about how what they said made you feel? As a boss, that's your responsibility. And as someone who works in that industry, in the back of the house, the dynamic is only changed by being brave enough to say something when you see something.
Thank you to Naomi for sharing her thoughts on what it really means to be a boss and for encouraging us to take advantage of teachable moments. Next up is Vivian Zhang of On She Goes, the travel site for women of color. What does Vivian think the future of food is? Let's find out.
We've always lived in a world where travel inspires food. That's why the spice trade happened. That's how my parents started their Chinese restaurant in America. It's pretty simple. Traveling inspires food around us. But because traveling is so accessible now, food inspires where we go. That's part of the itinerary more than ever. Thanks to Eater, hashtag food porn, Yelp, finding the best new places to eat is easier than ever. It's a thrill and an adventure to try new foods. You come home and you get to tell your friends and family, it's like, oh, I tried this new place, you've got to go. And as traveling increases, it allows us to push the boundaries and experiment even more. but more importantly, it's created a demand for it. I remember my parents used to cook duck or congee, and even bok choy. To me, that's so normal, but when people would come in our restaurant, they would be like, what is this? This is so foreign, it's so weird. But because of traveling and the internet, it's now normal, and I think it's such a beautiful thing. And the more exposure that we get from different foods and traveling, it makes people more open-minded to new taste, and also opens up a market where you get to bring your story back to your hometowns and share it with people who can't travel, because traveling is expensive. And that's why we created On She Goes, to help make it something that's more approachable. So traveling also creates acceptance. It creates curiosity for other cultures. Some people travel to find the authenticity in their foods. I'm Chinese and I've never been to China. So I always have this curiosity of what is real Chinese food. But in America, this is all I know. And what my parents make at home is my real Chinese food. And then some other people try fusion flavors. It's a creativity that you're like, oh, how did this person think of combining these different foods? It's so interesting and fun. But at the end of the day, what matters is that these meals bring people closer together. It doesn't matter if the people around you don't look like you or speak the same language as you. You're still all there for the love of food. So the two, traveling and food, will continue to inspire each other. You'll continue to melt the different cultures and the different stories of these chefs. And it'll just bring people and strangers and families and friends together and share a meal and a memory. And that's why I think the future of food is traveling. People are going to travel more, bring it back, travel some more, and bring it back. It's a really cool cycle. And I think it happens here every day in Portland. You see it with all the different restaurants. And it's just going to keep melting together.
Thank you, Vivian. Be sure to check out onshegoes.com for more about understanding ourselves and the world around us through travel. Next up is Naz Shaheen, writer, artist, and Cherry Bomb contributor. Naz founded a website called Motherland that celebrates makers, and she's here to tell us more.
I like stories. I like reading them. I like writing them. I like curating them, which is what I was doing for Cherry Bomb. My column was a mixed bag of two sentences long short stories, culinary tidbits, as I like to think about them. Here's an example. Vegetarian restaurant number one. The first vegetarian restaurant in the United States opened on West 23rd Street in Manhattan in 1895. It was co-founded by Louise Walkman, a music teacher and an activist for women's rights. So, I also like shopping stories. I found this turmeric on Instagram, and it stood out because it has beautiful packaging. It looks really pretty. But then I went to their site and read the story that Sana, the creator of this brand, wrote. It's a really long essay on how and why she created this brand that sells this very special turmeric. So after reading this story, it's very hard for me to want any other turmeric than this one. So I ordered it in, and the shipment got delayed. It didn't arrive for days, and she sent me a very sweet email apologizing for the inconvenience, since we live in the age of Amazon Prime. Did I care? No, not at all, because I wasn't buying this turmeric because I needed turmeric. I was buying this turmeric to become a part of her story. So I just told her, oh, it's fine. I'm very happy that you're so busy. You're running out of your shipping supplies. I love small and curated stores, and I try to shop exclusively from them, even though it might be inconvenient or slightly more expensive at times. This is just how I feed myself with the stories behind these products. So I decided to start a store like that myself. It's called Motherland, it's brand new. So this is something I offer. So it's mulberry preserves imported from Lebanon. And I like this because I love mulberries. They were my favorite fruit when I was growing up in Turkey. It's such a nostalgic ingredient for me. It's kind of hard to come across in the US. I like it because it's delicious and all natural and et cetera. But I love it because I found out that this brand was started by two sisters in a tiny, picturesque mountain village cut off from the rest of the country during the Lebanese Civil War, because they wanted to employ the woman in the village who had, you know, nothing to do with their time and orchards just overflowing with fruit. So they started bottling up and preserving their fruit, and their husbands who were coming back from the war became their taste testers, and their children became their packaging designers, and like they were sticking the labels on. It's such a sweet story. And now after 25 years later, they are still producing this thing in the same old beautiful stone barn where it all began, with the same, you know, traditional and gentle methods they've been using for ages. So it makes this special, it makes this product very special for me. So when I'm passing this on, I want to make sure that the story comes along with it and it just doesn't blend in with all these other gems in the shelf in the Middle Eastern grocery store that also sells them, because like you need to know the story. So when I'm, you know, mixing spoonfuls of this to my yogurt in the morning, I daydream about this old stone barn and these two sisters, and I want to do the same with everything I eat and drink and cook with. And yeah, so I discovered that I became very romantic in that sense, and I like that. And I urge you to be romantic, to get romantic about your product. Like if you are selling a very special product, just tell its story. Or if you know people who have amazing stories but don't have the means to tell them, just help them tell their stories and help them have a voice. Because I feel like, you know, being healthy, fair, it's just, it's not enough. Like with, you know, markets getting bigger and bigger and aisles getting more crowded and crowded with good quality products, it's just people are just looking for more. Like they're looking for a connection, and that's where the story comes in. Thank you.
Thank you, Naz. People are craving connection and community, and that goes to the heart of why we started Cherry Bomb. You can check out Naz's website at motherlandisnowhere.com. Before we get to our Portland panel, let's return to my chat with Sarah Furno about the best ways to cook with Kerrygold. I know you're all eager to hear more about this inverted burger. I certainly am. You're definitely going to want to make this recipe this weekend, so be sure to take notes. Here's farmhouse cheesemaker Sarah Furno describing her go-to recipe that includes Kerrygold Cashel Blue Irish farmhouse cheese.
I buy some good quality ground steak mince. I will sweat off a small amount of diced onion and just mix that in with ground mince. And then I take a small amount of blue cheese and I make a hole in the burger patty and pop it into the center and just close it back up. And then as the burger is cooking, of course, the blue cheese melts in the center. So when you bite into your burger, you've got a little sauce, a little surprise.
And who doesn't want that?
It captures the flavor of the cheese very well and just adds a complementary element to the burger. So it works well. It's good. It's very easy as well.
Want to make your own inverted burger with Kerrygold Cashel Blue Irish farmhouse cheese? Or maybe some Kerrygold aged cheddar cheese? Visit KerrygoldUSA.com to find out where you can purchase their award-winning butter and cheese. That's KerrygoldUSA.com. Welcome back. It was such an honor to be in Portland and learn more about the incredible women on the food scene there. Our panelists really exemplify what makes this city so vibrant. You're about to hear from Michelle Batista, co-owner of the Knightwood Society, Chef Arlen Frank of Platano Rising, Kim Malik, co-founder and CEO of Salt and Straw, Nong Poon Sakwatana, founder of Nong's Kamungai, and wellness guru Allison Wu of Wu House.
When you hear the term the future of food, what immediately comes to mind?
This group of women that I work with here, this is what we talk about every day. So this is why the tote bags, it was part of our Kickstarter campaign. And it's been interesting to see how men engage that conversation. And somehow, when we were going through the election, and this is when the Future is Female shirts came out, right? You saw men wearing them, and they were champions of this idea that we would have a female president. And I think that that was the big catalyst for that mantra during that time. And then when we launched the Kickstarter, our dear friend Kate Sokoloff, who's not here today, but is friends with a lot of people in this room, was like, I think we should really start talking about how the future of food is female. And it was a big challenge. And we sort of put it out there, and we got plenty of pushback from the male community, especially men in food. And so to Naomi's point earlier, it's not about, for us, it's not about winning. It's about equalizing the playing field. And so that's what we talk about all the time, and we need more men in this room always. Thank you to, I think there's two of you, three of you maybe with Kevin back here. But one in the back, Dad. So I think that for us, we want to share the stage and have an equal playing field so we can all have a voice. And that's what we're fighting for, which seems crazy, right? That we're in 2018 and we're still fighting for equality. But that's the goal. So when I think about what the future of food is or the future of is female, it's just an equal stake in the game.
In regards to the future of food, I feel like I am here today because we're thinking a little bit more forward, right? We have feminists and we have the strides that we're making as feminists. We are understanding this concept and cherishing the value of it, but there is a missing piece to move forward, and it's intersectionality. So the future is female, the future is femme, the future is us coming together, but there's a missing piece to move forward, and it's that we need to look out for all women. We need to, in the 10 years that I've been in and out of kitchens and cooking, I was like, okay, so there's this strong white woman that just got this management position, and why is she not looking out for the Latina woman that is the cook? Why doesn't she want the same things for herself, for this person that is basically settling for a wage that is not livable? Yeah, we have to also consider that and think about it, what it is that we need to do, because at the end of the day, we all have these commonalities as women, and we need to, like, and that's why I'm really also very thankful for the Cherry Bomb platform, because I feel like I didn't come here, wasn't put here tokenized. I wasn't put here as like, oh, the black girl in the panel. I felt like these people have genuinely given me a voice and want to listen. It's important for us to move forward in the future. What I envision is a kitchen where everybody is, all the women are looking out for each other, because we have a very global, very similar experience. So yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Kim, you get to follow that.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that I get to follow you, because the only kind of, when I think about the future of food, and thank you for saying that, it's amazing. When I think about the future in general, the only thing that I can really think about right now is the fact that at our borders, we're tearing mothers away from their children right now. We're doing that in the United States. So I was thinking about this question about food and what the future of food. And of course, in the back of my head, this is what I'm thinking of. I mean, the way forward, the future of food, I mean, if we're so afraid of people that we can't even allow them to keep their, like, we are going to put our fear back on them by taking their children away from them, and somehow that's going to, I don't know what that's going to do. It's going to mess up the world. But food is the one thing I think that people can sit down together and eat together and experience other cultures. But they have to do it through that person. So that's our opportunity. You know, I just flew in from Boise, Idaho, you guys. It's beautiful there. And they have a lot of great food there, but they're like on this border where there's also a lot of, things look a lot the same, you know, in different neighborhoods and things like that. And it just made me think, like, this is our opportunity as we grow as a company and as we support others around us to give a voice to everyone. And I think if you're eating someone's food, you're getting to know their history, their family, their culture, and it helps us understand where those divisions are coming from and how we can break those down. And so that's all I can think about right now. And, you know, I work in food, and so I hope that that's going to be part of the solution, and I believe that it can be.
Thank you. So, Nong, thank you for being on the panel today. And thank you for bringing your baby. So for you, the future of food, what is it?
I think that when I thought, I also want to say one thing is that where I grew up in Bangkok, and my father is alcoholic, abusive man. So I grew up with very bad men. Why I say that, because I just kind of want you to know a little bit about where I'm coming from. And for future of food, for me, I would like to say it. Oh, I forgot to say one thing. I'm grateful for the privilege to holding the microphone and speak right now, because your voice is as important as mine. I would like to speak of the answer the question of the future of food to my voice to my view of kamangkai chicken and rice that I make. Because I see my answer is international, because when I first started the food cart, nobody know what like kamangkai is or the authentic food is. I came to United States in 2003. I worked as a waitress right away at the first month at the Chinese buffet restaurant. I pick up the grapes from the carpet floor. So I didn't understand the food in America back then, let's say like Chinese American food. And then to the journey that when I opened a food cart in 2009, I have lived here for about 7 years. And that's when I was just have the idea to make the most authentic chicken and rice that, or the best chicken rice that I can make. Because where I'm coming from in Bangkok, there is hundreds of food vendors at the market, so you have to be good, and they each just do one or two things. So that was my... Anyway, with the now that I see, now that I have children, my own, he's 9 months old, and see the children as my new customer, which I never even thought of them before, but apparently children love chicken and rice. So I didn't know that. Well, because I was picking grapes and children came to the restaurant and dropped over the grapes, and then the grapes were, so I didn't want the children at the restaurant, I'm being honest. And then now it's like children love chicken rice, and the parents bring them. I see that now I am impressed, and I see that, like, you know, children has access to see the real authentic food, or they are open and they don't judge. You know, I think that's the privilege that we have, and then also with the technology that we have, that we can. You can find the recipe online to make something for your children. And it doesn't have to be expensive. But I think for me, if talk about product-wise, I think that we can show our children the variety of food, and it because it's opened their world. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Noh. I am not leaving Portland without some kamangkai, absolutely. So you have a lot of fans. All right, Allison, the future of food. You're coming at it from a very different place, you know, from chefs and some of the industry people in here.
Yeah, I would say the future of food for me is mindfulness, greater awareness of the connection between what we're putting in our bodies and how it affects every aspect of our lives, from not just our physical bodies, but our minds and our moods, and how it affects the planet and the animals that live on the planet other than just us. And just, yeah, greater consciousness around overall, I think we need to just think about the choices that we make and the brands that we support and where our food is coming from and who's growing it. And I feel like we're really lucky to live in Portland, and it feels like a bubble here, but a lot of my work is trying to reach and make, you know, some concepts more accessible to people all over the country and all over the world that, you know, aren't fortunate enough to live in Portland, where we are way more conscious and we are, you know, have an amazing local food movement here. So for me, it's mindfulness and just greater awareness of our choices.
Well, we found you in Brooklyn, so we have our own bubble in Brooklyn, as I'm sure you've heard. All right, I'm going to jump ahead because I know we have some people in the audience who would like to ask some questions of our panelists. So we're going to jump ahead to the 2028 question. So Michelle, what do you see for yourself and for your businesses in 2028?
Katie, my business partner back there, who has a torn hamstring, and I were talking about this before. Mm-hmm. She's a trooper, though. She actually tore her hamstring running from here home to come back for an event. And tripped and fell. Anyway, it was tragedy. We were talking about this question in particular because, I mean, it's a little bit loaded for me. I tend to move quickly, as my ladies would attest. And so for me, I am a bit of a planner. I'm a little bit like you, but then I also vision and plan out far. So I'm a bit of an in-between. So when I think about the next 10 years, I mean, I want to do 10,000 things in the next 10 years. But when I think about, if I think about this group of women and the women that will come and how this scales and how the movement scales and grows, I can say that, you know, what I want to see, again, like we're all fighting for equality in gender, in race, intersectional feminism, like, and that's our big mission. So when I think about 10 years, I absolutely want us to be level. But when I think about us in 10 years and what the businesses will be doing in 10 years and where food is going to be in 10 years, I really want to see people eating in local food systems. I want to see more sustainable food systems. I want to see more women in the kitchen. I want to see really healthy culture. Kim, we talk about culture all the time here. This is the big catalyst for change, I think, and how effectively those of us that own businesses and are entrepreneurs, and even if you're not, how you can push for culture change within your organization, that is going to be the biggest catalyst for us to move forward. So, I mean, I have big goals for in 10 years.
Allison, how mindful will we be in 2028?
Well, that remains to be seen. Yeah, I mean, I feel like we're already moving in that direction. So I think just trying to reach more people, like I was saying, with just living in a place that's very progressive, and how can I personally reach more people in a greater geography and just go on more tours or like meet people face to face and give more talks. And I want to write a couple books hopefully in 10 years. And I'm working on a brick and mortar concept for Portland. So yeah, I have some things up my sleeve, and hopefully just keep spreading the message that, you know, there's little, if we take care of our individual selves, we're able to show up and be there for the people in our community and just be more mindful overall. So keep my personal message, and a lot of what I talk about is self-care and mindfulness. And so keep spreading that to people and sending the message that every single person is deserving and worth self-care and love. So
we might see an actual Woo House one day.
Maybe.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Nong, how about you? 2028 for you and your businesses.
Yes. So in 2028, actually this goal, I just, because I'm a horrible planner, I just kind of roll with the punches, but it's a new goal for me. So I want to be able to retire in 2028, in 10 years. Yeah. Or I might be still working, because as the entrepreneur journey, I have found that a lot of the ideas is that like you work and build your business, and then maybe one day you sell it. But as an immigrant, you know, we run the restaurant until we're old. And then so I was like, you know, maybe I'm 70 and I still like be a cash register and take your orders. But I want to be able to have a financial freedom. And if the message I can give to you, if I came from Thailand in 2009, with a little money, I would like to tell you all that I want to support the idea that you can have it all and you can do it. And it's hard work, but it's work progress. Also, I think that to the journey won't be able to achieve with just female, or can have help with both male, and and female. Therefore, I would like, because I would like to tell myself too that I can do it, I can have it all, I can have a successful business and a successful personal life. And I can hope that I can inspire anyone in this room and others, because I think that we should help each other and lift each other up. And strong women intimidate weak women. So just as a woman ourselves, we have to fight men, we have to fight our own female, because they come too, you know. But how can we protect our heart and don't let them stab it? Because when you make your own product, I don't know who are the audience, which level you at your business, or even you think about start the business. But when you give your product, this is your heart, you put yourself out here, and people gonna come and then gonna step and poke and how. But it took me a long time to protect your heart, and I got this advice from another female. So thank you.
Thank you.
Love your heart.
Kim.
2012. I almost fell over when I saw that number, because I've been planning for the year 2020 for so long that I'm like, oh no, it's almost here, and now what are we gonna do? But I don't know, we're growing a lot at Salt and Straw, and we have 15 stores now, which is unbelievable to me. And as I think about 10 years ahead, I think a lot about this idea of growth being, you know, using your superpowers for good. And growth doesn't have to mean like the same thing in every city all across the world. I mean, when we open a new store, we start from scratch and open a brand new menu, working with local artisans and farmers. And it's so much harder and more expensive and takes so much more time. But, you know, I think it's like one of the reasons that people in Los Angeles feel like this great affinity toward their own thing that they have. That's very different than what you would find in Portland. The menu's different. The people we work with are different, all of these things. And so, you know, when we decided to move outside of Portland, we could have just shipped our ice cream all over the country and people probably would have liked it. But instead we thought, let's ship that ethos of Portland to other parts of the country and do that. We always say, I think we learned this from Stumptown, if there's a harder, more expensive way to do it, we'll do it. We'll find it. And, you know, then I think about, you know, the culture of our company and what it means to work in the hospitality industry and have a career there that's well-paying and offers you training and flexibility to be a great, you know, parent with a balanced life. And I think that what it means to have a career in the hospitality industry is going to be a lot different than it is now, 10 years from now. And we hope to be an important part of that, because it's an important part of our culture and can offer, I think, a lot of paths forward to whether it's breaking down those misunderstandings that we have amongst cultures or giving people their first step forward when they are entering the workforce for whatever reason. So, I mean, I feel like businesses have to be at the table along with politicians and along with the nonprofits to make a change in this world. And businesses can't be on the outside taking. We've got to be at the table and part of the solution if we're going to move these things forward. And I think we can be. And so I'm excited about that. And I think there's some real tangible ways that we can all participate in that.
Great. Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
When posed the question of where I will be in 2028, I like to share that what fuels me, what keeps me up at night, is, and what I hope is my legacy in the world, is that I have this unique experience. I am an immigrant as well, first generation immigrant. So there are things that I observe from my parents growing up, from the economy in the country that I come from, which is the Dominican Republic. I am part of the African diaspora and moving towards what it means to me to be part of the American dream. My family and I, we moved here for safety. We moved for dreams of progressing. So I have over my head a responsibility. And I am in Portland, Oregon strategically. And it's so much of the elements that the women here shared. Like, I feel like I would be successful if I get to a place in that specific year or before or after where I can create a system where I can use this local nourishment, this local economy to facilitate food for the working class, for people like me. It doesn't matter where my height of the success is. The way that I present and the way that I look and who I am is always gonna put me in a position that people are gonna look at me a specific way. So I am always going to see myself like the people that are like myself. So I have a responsibility to constantly feed the working class. I would like to have one day a line of food that is very accessible for students. I know what it is to have food insecurity. Anybody that's been in this room that know what is to be hungry or not know where the next meal is gonna come from, that stuff is very tough. We have kids in schools, in high schools, that are coming into our schools right here in American soil hungry. I have a responsibility to work out a system where, yeah, I am a little bit of a food snob too. I love like delicious, crispy food, beautiful pictures, the industry of the food in itself, where it's just like, wow, these people are so talented and fancy and sophisticated. But but where are we creating this like access for the people that basically fuel our economy, like the construction workers, the teachers, the, like I was saying, the kids that are crossing the street to eat at McDonald's because they only have like $2 for lunch. Like, we need to nourish the economy, the people, the beings that power our country. And I think that that's where I would like to, where I see myself doing. I like to sustain the American economy because I now consider myself American. I've been here long enough and I have American citizenship. Somehow people can count on like my products or the other people that want to do it as well to something that is going to be hearty, something that's going to be fresh, something that's going to nourish them and fuel them for their ideas and their creativity and what it is that they want to do. And then part of the proceeds, I would like for it to go back into the Caribbean. So that's where I see myself. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we all want you to make that happen. So, all right, we have time for a few questions. And like Nong had said, everybody's opinions are important, not just the people with the microphones. So if anyone has some questions, raise your hand. I will try to run to you with the microphone. Oh, come on over. The wire's not that long. So you get to come to me. All right, and tell us who you are.
I am Lisa Ramirez with B-Cells and Solo Club. My question is, with a lot of these smaller like mom and pop shops, like the super small guys, and with labor wages increasing in Portland, there's been talk about the individual restaurants collaborating together financially to maybe like ride some of these waves together. What is your opinion on that? Do you think it's possible in 10 years, 20 years to like band together for some of these powerhouses like Salt and Straw to help out like smaller businesses for success?
Great question. Anybody want to tackle that?
That's a good question.
You go, Kim.
Oh, did you have a...
No, no.
Well, I mean, I think it's a great idea. And I mean, it's scary. All of the challenges, I always say, like, do they want us to be in business? I mean, it's really hard right now. And I think, I mean, our company personally, we just were granted a tax break from the city of Portland to create an incubator program so that we could help other companies that are just starting to get off the ground, and whether it's with their manufacturing or their HR or their food safety or their marketing, like here's all the things we've learned in the past 7 years and a little program that we can help you kind of get going. Oh, and by the way, we'll be your biggest customer because we'll sell your product in our ice cream and in our shops. And it's just sort of a nice, sustainable way for people to help each other through business, because I think that's what's really important. You know, we can all have these initiatives, but it's got to be sustainable for both parties. So yeah, I definitely think that there's an opportunity for us to band together. And I think it's funny because, you know, there are all these rising voices about
a lot of things that affect the hospitality industry, but we're not very good about organizing ourselves as a voice, and not against what's being said, but to at least have a voice as part of it. And so I think that at a minimum is really important as well.
Restaurants are really hard. We're not a restaurant. I mean, I'll just say that, which grants us a little bit of license to flex and shift and bend and be a little bit putty, I like to say.
You might be the future of restaurants, though.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that this is the conversation, and I mean, Nong should speak. She's the only one on the panel that has a brick and mortar restaurant, I think, right now, and so it'd be good to hear from her. But I've worked in and around restaurants and been intimately involved in restaurants, and when I decided that I wanted to do this, the conversation was more about a vehicle of food to consumers, a vehicle from a farm or a farmer through this conduit of experience to, you know, to a table, to a mouth, to a child, to a couple, you know, getting married, or a corporation who wants to learn how to do something new. And so we are constantly within these walls right now anyway, challenging what is a food vehicle, and not necessarily the restaurant is not the only way to do that anymore. And so we've shifted that part of the conversation a little bit, and it's working within this small space, but getting other people to collaborate or to share ideas has been challenging, other restaurants, I would say. And so it's going to be interesting. I mean, we really want to take down some of the barriers and work together. We're trying to create a network right now of other venues that want to give people different food experiences, even other restaurants that may want to book out private events where they're able to work with Nike and teach them how to make cheese or butcher a pig or whatever that is, because people are coming. People are coming and asking for it, and we're trying to figure out how to collaborate as a city, quite frankly, and then sort of offer them this other experience. But we don't have the same challenges that a restaurant does. We book an event, we order the product, we put labor in place, and we execute that event. We don't have people standing around, and if people don't walk in, you're losing money. So it's a little bit different.
Naomi, can you weigh in? Do you mind?
Please, Naomi.
Yeah, I knew this was gonna happen. Yeah, I mean, going back to that question about the future of collaboration with like restaurants that maybe are larger with restaurants that are smaller, I think for sure that's gonna happen. Because I think, you know, as somebody who runs a restaurant that's gonna be 11 this year, I face a lot of issues with that. You know, it's like with the Instagram culture that we're all living in, people are really into whatever is new. You know, it's like all about like the newest, greatest, everything. And so as a restaurateur, you know, that runs a small place that's incredibly not accessible to the majority of people, it's very expensive to eat at my restaurant. I have a cocktail bar that's across the street that serves food and is a real restaurant. If you guys didn't know that, you can get a full meal at Expatriate. But, you know, so diversification being a really important part of that conversation, the question about what to do to stay relevant, to keep going, and all of that stuff probably will have to do with collaboration. I've noticed that, obviously, you know, I've been doing that for my 10th anniversary this year. Invited 10, actually it's going to be 11, I think, but 10 of my favorite chefs from across the country to come and cook with me at Beast as like this moment of, hey, I'm going to take a risk and invite these people that I really think are like the super badasses. And it was a scary thing to just say like, hi, you know, Nancy Silverton, come and cook at my restaurant, you know. But that collaboration kind of, it drives a lot of business, you know, and also I think it gives this like really awesome feeling, just so much, you know, going back to what Nas was saying about telling stories, you know, and about the value of that, that I think the story of collaboration, the story of Kim and working with purveyors and working with, you know, development of new systems to put in place that are going to help the environment, that's kind of the future of everything, right? Like that about helping people, about supporting each other, and about coming together and doing something fun together, because it's, I think it's innate from pips, that he has that hashtag on his Instagram that says community, not competition. And I think that that's what I'm going to leave you with.
Thank you. Nong, you want to get the last word?
So you talk about the group, like restaurant group. I am not with the Restaurants Association. If anyone has a restaurant, probably heard of that. And I think it's like the group of the restaurant, and then like they have a, so I don't know much about them. Anyway, I'm not with them because when I had the food cart, I heard that the food cart was intimidate the restaurant. So they do everything to kind of to protect like the restaurant industry. So you form a group and then you can go talk to the city and all that. You know, I just want to let you know that I'm not in the group. they came, but I didn't. Even now I have a restaurant. So I'm in between because I have food cart and restaurant, you know. But to answer for your question, I think that it's not just the restaurant industry. What about people that like pick strawberries or cherries? You know, it will affect a lot of industries, not just a restaurant. And then I also wasn't good to collab with other people. I think that partially was because I'm immigrant and I kind of, like I didn't know much, but I learned. Therefore, my answer to you is that raise of minimum wage is scary, not just to you or restaurant industry. There's a lot of industry. But it did force us to think, because as an entrepreneur, you have to adapt. And that is another thing to adapt, and it forced you to think. And then maybe it's for you to think of like, how do I make the product and less people? How do I make this product without compromise the quality that I do? And or maybe like, you know, or anything. Also, my advice to you is that don't afraid to charge them for money. And I got this advice from a book, yeah, called Woman and Money, that I bought from Fred Meyer for $9.99. Yeah, she has a show on CNN. Yeah, one of the advice is that you don't afraid to charge for the money. And, it, you know, you got to pay to play. And then, but it does, it's also, like Naomi said, you have to be able to tell the story and, like, why I charge you this. You know, and then also like, because that's how you do whatever you can. It doesn't mean that they're gonna come, but you keep do. Maybe someone will notice you, you know, and then so make them pay. Also think like how we can, because you don't wanna price yourself out as well, you know. That's the homework to think. That's my answer.
Thank you.
That's great advice to end on. Like Nong said, know your worth. The Cherry Bomb team had a wonderful time in Portland. We visited when the roses were in bloom, a spectacular time to see the city. And we ate at so many great places, from Naomi Pomeroy's Expatriate, where we had shrimp toast and natural wine. A personal thrill for me was trying salt and straw ice cream for the first time. And lucky me, I got to try a collab flavor salt and straw did with Chef Tracy Desjardins. Ready for this? The flavor is duck crackling and cherry preserve ice cream. We visited our friends at Stumptown headquarters. We had Kamung Gai from Nong's original street cart. And we had chocolate buttermilk bergamot donuts from Katie Pope's Blue Star Donuts. Oh, and thank you to Annie Portlock of Annie Pies for dropping off some s'mores pies for us. We did not eat all of this at once, in case you're wondering. But do go visit our friends in Portland. You'll have a great time. Our show was produced by Jess Seidman and supported by Kerrygold. Thank you to everyone at the Knightwood Society for supporting our event. Thank you to all of our speakers, and thank you to all the amazing members of the Bomb Squad who packed into the venue for this taping. Thank you for listening to the Future of Food miniseries. Here's to a delicious tomorrow.